but I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, but then a computer would have to be doing the work of everything. Well, let's say we're going, let's say, from east to west, you know, an east, a horizontal setup. The computer would have to be, you know, looking at every one of those locations from one end to the other, and then compensating for, you know, the distance that it's now off, you know, as far as, if when it's looking at it straight, they're all coming in at the same time. But when you turn it, one's on the right, if you're turning to the right, they're going to take longer to get there. So, you know, I would assume all the different points, or what I would call pixels, I guess. So naturally, this is all going into a CCD, but everyone would have to be, you know, computed. And then, of course, you talked about having one, a northern and a southern setup, you know, making it a not only horizontal but a vertical setup. So that's why you need all this computing power, correct?
Yes, Paul, you're a lot closer to the truth. And you made it sound like the computer knows that you've rotated the antenna 2 degrees, and it knows it has to add let's assume that 2 degrees gave you 90 degrees phase shift. And you make it sound like it knows it's got to add 90 degrees to one antenna and subtract 90 degrees from the other antenna. That's one way of looking at it. It does something a little more complicated than that. It takes that whole DON data set, looks at it all at once with a very complicated program, which is really called an inverse Fourier transform, in order to re-derive what the real picture is. The picture is one dot of the one star, even though the antenna pattern you got with the experiment you ran shows a whole lot of lobes, as if there was a whole lot of star, individual stars out there. Each individual side lobe could be misinterpreted as an individual star. In other words, as you sweep that antenna, and if you just plotted that as brightness on a screen, you would have a whole bunch of dots of individual stars horizontally displaced, and the center star would be a little bit brighter, the two outer to the left and to the right of that would be a little bit dimmer, and so on. That's the raw data. But that data set, if the computer knows enough about the mechanical layout of your interferometer, and it looks at that whole data set at once, it knows how to crank that all back out by the inverse Fourier transform, and you'll eventually get one simple picture of one dot in the center. Now, that's the simple picture of a single star. Let me drop. In reality, you might be looking at the Pleiades. You might be looking at a whole group of stars. And so each one of those lobes of your antenna pattern is making multiple hits of each of those stars, if you know what I mean. So in the real world, you have the computer program has got to look at that whole complicated antenna pattern you get and crank it back out as to what the picture really is. But that is doable for modern-day computers. But the other main function I'm telling you here is that every antenna pattern, where did the pattern come from? It's interferometry. The so-called diffraction-limited telescope, the formula that the astronomers use, is 1.22 times lambda over d. That is the diffraction-limiting number for your telescope represented in radians. And if you don't like the 1.22 times lambda over d, you plug in 70 degrees times lambda over d. It's the exact same thing. If you live in the degree world, and then you can divide that down into minutes of arc and seconds of arc and so on. So the resolution, the angular resolution of your telescope by that formula is the diffraction limit. It really is the antenna pattern. The antenna pattern is called diffraction limited if and only if all of your parabolic mirror, so to speak, has something like a 20th of a degree of accuracy of that parabola. Let me drop. And if you've got bumps and valleys and peaks and scratches and everything else in your mirror, then you're going to get a more complicated picture, a more complicated antenna pattern, so to speak. By the way, you notice that the picture you get out of a telescope could be called its antenna pattern. When you study what the side lobes and the main lobe looks like on a Yagi pattern. A Yagi really is a diffraction-limited kind of an antenna. The so-called airy disc that you have when you take a picture of one single star with your telescope, and that complicated picture you get with a bright dot in the center and a bunch of rings around it, much dimmer rings. It's called the airy disc. Turns out your Yagi antenna gives you the exact same antenna pattern, and those rings around the side, we call them side lobes, but they really are rings in three-dimensional space in the antenna pattern. Turns out that our Yagis we've been looking at have got an airy disc antenna pattern to them, very similar to an optical telescope. The difference between a Yagi antenna and a telescope is only the wavelength. The theory of operation has got a strong degree of similarity. WS2N, KQRIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, so I asked us when it all came out with interferometry, I don't know, I remember in the 80s, late 80s, they were talking about setting these things up eventually, you know, further and further apart. There's one big setup going on in South Africa somewhere. And they, you know, they're getting like, you know, thousands of miles apart. And they said eventually you could have satellites in space doing the same thing. Now you've got them, you know, tens of thousands of miles apart. But to do this, you needed all this tremendous computing power. I'm starting to see why you need that. That's good, Dick. We'll pay attention as time goes on with this topic. Back to that WS class.
Yeah, there's a lot more to the story, but at least we scratched the surface. And I think we go on to the space section now, Paul. WS2N, what's NASA doing this week? What's Rosetta doing? K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
We'll be following Rosetta. I know Billy has not come back to life yet, but we'll have to wait. They said months and months from now, they're going to hope that thing are sitting on Comet 67P comes back and says hello to Rosetta. They use Rosetta as a repeater, of course, because the signal would be too weak. They transmit up to Rosetta, and Rosetta sends the signal back to Earth. You know, and right now it's the equivalent of being like 3 AU out, you know, the distance between the sun and the Earth. It's amazing to think that they've succeeded in landing our spacecraft on a comet. Very well done by the European Space Agency. And we'll have to see what happens in the future. It'll follow it around. We'll follow that story for about a year. But I did want to talk about Hayabusa 2, the Japanese spacecraft. I know I talked about it again last week. Then as I was listening to the ClubNet last week, you know, they always have amateur news line comes on after that. And right away they started talking about Hayabusa 2. And it turns out they have amateur radio on board. Now, Hayabusa 2 is a spacecraft going to be launched from Japan. The second. It was supposed to go off a couple of days ago, but, you know, weather problems. All these spaceports have the same problem with weather. They have certain flight rules, and there was some fog and crystal atmosphere going up above them. And that shut down the flight for a couple of days ago. So I think on the second Tuesday, they'll be launching from Japan. It'll take a few years before it gets to its destination, asteroid. And when it gets there, it'll spend over a year investigating the asteroid. It's not really going to go in orbit. It's kind of like going to go along with it. And then toward the end, they'll go down very low to the asteroid, and they'll actually just touch it. And they have a grab it there, and they're going to try to get some material and bring it back. They successfully did this with Hayabusa 1, excuse me, but it didn't work out as planned. And they got a little bit back, but they want to get a lot more. So it turns out this thing has an amateur radio set up on board, and actually it's two of them. And by the way, it'll be going up on in December 2nd, which is Tuesday, 11:22 p.m. But they call the amateur radio Shin 2. It'll be eventually it's going to separate from the, apparently it's going to separate from Hayabusa, and it'll be put into an elliptical pad in orbit around the sun. That's where it's going to wind up. They have different frequencies. You can talk up to it and then talk back down to it. When it's in and near around the moon, they're going to use, I think the moon is a reflective thermometer. I really can't figure out too much exactly what they're doing here, but they're going to have a single sideband CW transponder uplink. Meters 145 940, so you'll be going using single sideband for that. It'll be lower sideband, and then the downlink will be on 70 centimeters, 435.280, and there's a range between that. It's really a transponder setup, so the uplink is really 145.940, and I wrote it down here, 145.960. And then the downlink range will be 435.260 and 435.80. And then they also have a beacon on 70 centimeters as well. 435.280. Correction. And that was the other one. 437.505. And then also going to have WSJT, WSJTEL, have telemetry being transmitted on 437.385. I don't concentrate enough on these amateur satellites. I don't really do it myself, but interesting when I come across it. There's also going to be another satellite on board that spacecraft, and they call it OnSat, and that's going to be one of these CubeSats, then the other one. And it's just going to be a beacon. You can't talk up to it. It's a CW beacon on 437.325. So, if you're going to hear this thing 1.8 million miles away, it's going to be pretty good. But that's the story on Hayabusa 2, Dick. Just two other launches I wanted to talk about. One, of course, is the Orion spacecraft. That's getting ready to launch on the 4th of December. And we talk about this probably every week. And that'll be the unmanned flight launch from Florida on the Delta IV Heavy. Three core stages, three Delta IVs really bolted together. And an upper stage, all liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And that'll put the Orion into a just a two-orbit flight. Apogee will be 3,600 miles. The main purpose is to check out its heat shield, the biggest one ever made, about 16 feet in diameter. And, of course, they'll test out the parachutes as well. It's 12 different parachutes that come out of the Orion for different purposes. We'll see if the fairings separate properly. That's going to be protecting the whole craft, including the service module. And there's three bearings that come on the side, you know, and they'll spring out away from the craft once it's in space. And, you know, even before it gets to its 3,800 mile altitude. And the reason they don't need the bearings is because once they're in space, it adds weight. Now I look at the weight of each fairing, this three of them, is 1,000 pounds. So it's amazing, just a protection device, and actually to strengthen the whole structure during the launch. Fairings do that job, but I mean, to think that each one weighs 1,000 pounds, it's amazing. It looks like it's only a small part of the whole setup. Above that, on top of the Orion, they have the safety rocket setup built by Orbital Science, and there are four rockets that'll ignite after it's in space, and it'll pull the protective cover away from the Orion spacecraft. I say Apollo because it kind of looks like that. And, you know, we're busy with getting ready for our eventually manned Orion's flight, which would be probably in 2020. The only ones, India is actually getting ready to eventually put men on board their own spacecraft. And they plan on doing that within about 3 or 4 years. But to test out their craft this week as well. They're going to launch from India. It's their own capsule. So of course, it's unmanned. But they want to see how their spacecraft is going to do on its own, you know, cut back through and test their heat shield. And that's just going to be a suborbital flight. They have a rocket to get them in space, but they don't have a second stage on top to really get them to altitude or even to orbit. But the idea, what happened was they have a brand new rocket that's going up with booster rockets, and this will be their rocket of the future that will be landing. They are launching manned missions in orbit and eventually to the moon. And what they were going to do was they were going to just launch a mass load, a dummy piece. Just a heavy weight. And they said, well, instead of doing that, test our rocket, let's build India will eventually put people in. Okay, so they did that, and they built this 4-ton thing, and that's going to be their weight to test their rocket. They're killing two birds with one stone. See how their rocket flies, and at the same time, see how a close representation of future spacecraft that India will eventually put people in to not only orbit, but maybe go to the moon. So I just want to bring up those topics, and we'll turn it back to Ned. Back to you. This is WS2N.
I had the impression from what you've been telling us in the past, Paul, if I had a bit of memory, I'd know. How much bigger is Orion than Apollo? So, roughly what was the diameter of Apollo? And it could take as many as 3 astronauts. I have the impression Orion is larger in diameter, and I think it has the ability to take more than 3 astronauts. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes. And I'm starting to lose my voice. I'm starting to sound like Al. I had a cold here. Been fighting that for a while. Four will be on the first mission, and that's probably going to be the most that they take up. They built it with the capability of actually putting 7 on board when Orion was first designed, before the commercial companies got involved, SpaceX or Boeing. They were going to use Orion not only to go to the moon, but to resupply people and cargo to the space station. But right now it's changed to just 4 astronauts will be on board, and the first flight will be probably 2020. And the goal is to someday take an asteroid, put it into lunar orbit, and go to the moon with either 2 or 4 people, and dock with that little asteroid, and do an EVA, take some of the pieces from it, and bring it home. So that's one of the early goals of Orion, and future missions, of course, will be flights to Mars. Back to you. Diameter. This thing's roughly 16 feet, and Apollo was, I believe it was 13 or 14 feet something. But I think it was 13 and something. Roughly 14 feet. So this thing's quite, you know, when you say, you know, you go between 14 feet and 16 feet, it doesn't sound like much, but that's a big area. If you do the area of a cone, you know, it's pretty much what this thing is, a big cone, like similar shape to Apollo. It's a lot more square meter or cubic meter presence inside this spacecraft thing.
Now, the space shuttle had an upper deck and a lower deck. Since the Orion, in one of its configurations, in theory, had the ability to carry as many as 7 people, did the Orion command module have an upper deck and a lower deck, Paul?
No, not really. It's they would fly 4 and then 3, you know, 4 the close to the bottom and 3 near the top, but they would have all these foldable seats. Actually, you know who has that is SpaceX. If you look at their configuration, it's like that. And the same for the Boeing craft, the CST-100. You Google that, you can see the seating situation. Yeah, it kind of looks like 2 decks, but it's really not. But for long duration flights, you know, the thing goes off to Mars, there's no way that they would just put 4 people on board and shoot them to Mars and this thing. They'd never last. So there's plans of building habitat modules. Most likely, I think, Bigelow will probably win out. In the long run, Bigelow is a company that makes expandable modules. And they could be quite big. And if they do that, you know, there would be no problem in putting 4 people on board. You don't have living quarters, galleries, big places to exercise. You can't put 4 people in a small space capsule and blast them to Mars, you know, for a year and a, you know, 8 months there and 8 months back. No way. Back to you, Dick.
You know my opinion about a Mars mission of mankind. If at all, I think it's a long way off, cost-wise, risk-wise, a whole lot of reasons. Now, you told us that Hayabusa, 11:22 p.m. Tuesday, that's December 2nd, Orion, December 4th, that's Thursday. That sounds like we've got 2 major launches this coming week, Paul. Is that true? WS2N, K2RIW? By the way, are they both viewable on the right website?
Yeah, well, I put an app in the a NASA app in my tablet, so if I'm away, I can view it. But yeah, you've got Hayabusa will be shown as well, probably, I would think, but I'm not sure. Without a doubt, Orion will be. And the Indian mission, I doubt that, but that'll be coming up between the 15th and the 20th of this month. They want to see how that goes, a suborbital flight. But there's other missions. There's probably about, by the end of the year, probably about another 8 different flights. From Russia, another Aryan flight from French Guiana. You know, these are all some of our telecommunication satellites that are going to go to geosynchronous orbits. You know, it's way too many to cover, but the interesting ones, of course, I try to cover. Back to you, Dick.
In order to thoroughly test the Orion heat shield, it's going to go up to an apogee of 3,600 miles. I am guessing a highly elliptical orbit, and then it comes back down and crashes into the atmosphere at something close to the velocity you would have on a lunar return. That's a guess on my part. Maybe some rocket power is applied on the way down. So I presume you never circularize the orbit at 3,600 miles. It would take a lot of extra rocket power to circularize and then extra rocket power to come back down. So just to leave it as one very highly elliptical orbit means that the majority of the energy is spent getting to that apogee and a little bit of extra rocket power to bring you back down at the desired velocity, which I'm guessing is close to 25,000 miles an hour. I think the Apollo, let me drop. I think the Apollo mission on the way back from the moon, I think reached speeds of like 25,000 miles an hour that you hit the atmosphere with. So maybe that's what Orion is going to simulate and test. And you said 12 parachutes. Wow. Apollo had 3 parachutes. So I think you're saying that the 12 parachutes are various stages of droging, and these are not 12 major parachutes. I'm guessing it when it finally does splash down, it's going to be something like 4 or 5 parachutes, is a guess on my part. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, you know, Gemini had droves, Apollo had droves, you know, I mean, the final parachutes on Apollo, of course, are 3. But on Orion, you have... got this this cover coming off the front, which is going to expose the area where all these chutes are going to come out. So that cover is going to come off, and that also has piles on it, similar to the what they use on the space shuttle, protecting the sides from about roughly 3,000 degrees of heat. So after coming the atmosphere, you get down to around 400 miles an hour, so this piece will separate, and that has its own 3 little parachutes, so that's going to land in the water. But then you've got 2 other parachutes that come out from the Orion spacecraft, and they try to slow it down to around 300, and then they get released. And then you got 2 more drogue parachutes come out, and the idea of those is to pull the main chutes out, and then they'll pull out 3 big chutes. And the big chutes, they said, if you figured out the area of these 3 big main chutes, it would cover a football field, so it's rather large, and that slows the whole setup down to 20 miles an hour. It comes down, and you know, when it hits the water, it doesn't hit the bottom, it doesn't come down square, it comes down on an angle. So it'll try to cut it into the water to soften the blow, but you're still coming down around 20 miles per hour when you do hit the water. That's about the whole setup there.
As I remember on re-entry, one of the Apollo craft didn't have full inflation of all three chutes. I think one of them had two chutes inflated, one only partially inflated. And in the case of this Orion with three massive chutes, the area of a football field. Whoa. It's a rather heavy craft. Still hits at 20 miles an hour on an edge, so to speak. Not the flat bottom hitting the water. So it's going to dig in a little bit. And there's no real fallback position if all three chutes do not inflate. If two of them inflate and one decides not to, is that a... how bad would that situation be? Has that ever been mentioned, Paul? You do remember... was my memory mixed up with reference to Apollo not inflating all three chutes on one of the missions? WSQN, K2RIW?
That might have been one of your earlier missions. You know, the first was Apollo 7, Apollo 9, and Apollo... No, you know, let's see, it would be Apollo 7 and Apollo 9. I think it was one of those two. They were Earth flights. They didn't go to the moon. It was one of them. But, they've tested Orion. They've sent it up many times on an airplane, and they've dropped it out of the airplane, you know, like 10,000 feet high, and they've tested it with only two chutes opening, you know, to make sure that would work. So I guess three chutes is, you know, redundancy, but, you know, more is better than less. So yeah, they've addressed that problem, and they want to make sure that that's going to work okay. And Boeing will do the same thing with the CST 100, and so will the Dragon crew vehicle. That's going to have parachutes as well, although his ultimate goal is to have total propulsion landing all the way down, no parachutes. So, but I'm not sure which flight that was, Dick. Probably the one, maybe Apollo 7, first one, although I doubt it. I'll have to check which one did it open up all the way.
My memory was that it was one of the manned missions returning from the moon where one of the three chutes only partially inflated. It wasn't thoroughly collapsed, but it didn't fully inflate. And I guess the exact orientation of the capsule at the instant you deploy the chutes probably is a factor, although the way the drogue chutes come out, you would like to think that has all been normalized. Those parachutes are awfully important. If for any reason they don't come out, I think life gets pretty complicated pretty fast, doesn't it, Paul? K2LAW.
It certainly does. Let's see, we've had 9. It would be 9 flights that came back from the moon, so one of those 9. We'll have to look it up. It was either 8, 10, the one that landed 11, 12, 13, and went there, but that came back from the moon. It didn't make it down there. That was the Apollo 13, the one that had that mishap with the... on the way to the moon when the whole thing, one of the O2 systems blew. So you had 14, 15, and 16, and 17 after that. So that's 9 flights. One didn't open. Okay, we'll have to look into that. I can't imagine now which one that was. Then you had 10 Gemini flights. Could it have been one of those? There were 10 of them, plus the one man one.
I'm relatively sure it was an Apollo. Did Gemini also have three chutes, or was there only two chutes on Gemini? And how many chutes were on Mercury during reentry, Paul?
I thought Mercury had one and Gemini had two. But, We'll check it out, Dick. Let's see. flight school is Apollo 12, thinking back now, with P. Conrad. He had a lot of problems, but they overcame all of them.
It's amazing how close they came to real life-threatening situations. The worst one I know of was on Apollo 11, where Buzz Aldrin had to take apart a ballpoint pen and use portions of it to operate the arming switch where the handle had broken off. And without that arming switch being in the armed mode, in theory, you don't use the rocket to bring them back home. So, as simple as that sounds, had he not found that solution, there's no other way, so to speak, to operate that switch, because the handle has broken off. You don't think they had the time to take apart the instrument panel and put a clip lead behind those two contacts on the switch. Who's you, Paul? K2RIW.
You know, that's where they could have used the 3D printer that they now have on the International Space Station that was sent up there by SpaceX, and now it's operating. You could have made up a little handle, you know, they could have sent up a program, and he could have made up his own little tool. In fact, Apollo 13 could have used this with all the different parts there that they needed to try to get the scrubbers working for the carbon dioxide problem that they had building up. Remember, they had all different ductwork that they had to duplicate. They could have used this 3D printer. You know, they got a 3D printer on board the space station, right?
Yes, they do, but I'm a little worried about whether or not the material you get out of that would be strong enough to give you a handle for a switch. And when you plug it in, it wouldn't break off. I'd worry about that one. But concerning Apollo 11, there were a couple of close shaves there as I see it. I think the landing radar was turned on too soon, was overloading the computer, which was trying to do navigating. So they had tremendous computer overloads on landing. The original landing site was a rocky field, and Armstrong had to go and find a better place. And when he finally landed, I think there was like 15 seconds of fuel left, and they were giving him a countdown. And so had he not been on the ground, when you run out of fuel, I guess you then got to switch to the blast-off rocket. Does he have enough time to do that and just blast yourself back into space as if you had landed? So the overloaded computer, I'm not sure. I think an awful lot of the navigating at the end he had to do manually. A difficult landing, almost running out of fuel, the broken switch. Guarantee there were a few other things that happened that could have been life-threatening. Brave guys. Over you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, I've read a lot about Apollo 11, all those missions. And every one of them had their own problems that they had to overcome. So, but he had his hands full, and to hit the abort button, you know, blast himself back up to the mothership, which was Mike Collins going around all by himself. It would have been a tough job. They had to figure that no matter where they were, it would work. But once you got below a certain altitude, you know, said it wouldn't work, you know, you'd hit the button and it'd wind up crashing into the moon before, you know, you'd have enough velocity to get yourself away from the moon. And once they got below that point, then it was too late, and it was a point of no return. And they theorized that he had about 30 seconds left of fuel, but then some people say he had less than that. They've done the calculations over and over again. He was sticking his neck out. He got long. Because of the radar problem and the computer didn't have enough memory to do all this work at the same time. Kept giving him warning codes, and by the time they got all of it straightened out and got the go-ahead from Mission Control. He was downrange, and then he got himself all around these big boulders. Some of them were as big as houses, and he negotiated around that. But it worked out good. Back to you, Dick. I'm losing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Does somebody have a question? I go right ahead. Give us your call letters and name. 280. Mr. H.O. Sounds like Bernie. Go right ahead.
Be 280. Hilo. Howard. Soyuz, there was a failure of a parachute that failed to open. In Soyuz 1, it killed the cosmonaut.
Yeah, I do remember that one in Soyuz, Howard. But I'm pretty sure, though, that of the three chutes of the Apollo mission, one of the Apollo missions, I seem to remember two of the chutes were fully inflated and one was only partially inflated. So I think that brought them down a little bit faster. But that worked out all right. But what Paul and I were discussing now is that Apollo 11 had a number of circumstances where they were pretty close to getting in trouble. And as I see it, Paul, if they hadn't yet gotten to the point of no return, and they could have blasted back up because they could tell that they were too high, too far downrange, the computer wasn't working right, so abort the landing. I am guessing if they did an immediate abort, let me drop. An immediate abort would bring them back up to lunar orbit altitude where the command module was, command module and service module, but the timing would be wrong. I mean, that wasn't the intended approach. Therefore, they would be too close, they'd be too far downrange or too far uprange in orbit. They'd be at a nice spot in lunar orbit, but the command module wouldn't be there. I guarantee the maneuver required to get them to re-link up from an aborted landing, I suspect would have again been quite complicated. I wonder if that was ever mentioned, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I guess that's probably the reason the computer was so busy. It's doing all those calculations, too. And it could only handle so much. It would have to know, how much time the rocket would have to be ignited to get them to proper orbit to reach Columbia. And I'm sure they would have got somewhere up there. It would have been better than crashing down on the moon. And that what would have happened is Mike Collins would have had to fly himself over to the Eagle to rescue them if they, they tapped out of fuel.
Yeah, but to fly over to him, to link up, very simple sounding. You remember what happened on the early missions with Gemini when they tried to do a link up? And the very first attempt of linking up didn't work because you see a spacecraft that's in orbit with you, and it's ahead of you by a mile, let's say. You decide to speed up a little bit to catch up to it. But as soon as you increase your speed, that puts you into a larger radius orbit, which slows you down in angular velocity, and you end up falling behind them further. The link-up procedure is opposite of what you think. If the guy's in front of you by a mile and you want to link up with him, you blast your rocket toward him, that slows you down a little bit, that puts you into a lower orbit. The lower orbit speeds you up, so to speak. So you literally dive down under him and end up coming up to him, or end up coming up ahead of him, if you know what I mean. You blast the rocket away from him in order to go to him. Ain't that crazy? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know they, the first time they did it was with Gemini, was it Gemini 7 and 8, and That was Stafford. And then the other one was maybe he was the vice president of Eastern Airlines, Borman. And they weren't going to dock. I mean, the idea was to rendezvous. They did that. Borman and Lowell were up there for a 14-day mission for a long duration to see if two astronauts could sit in this thing for 2 weeks, like sitting in a Volkswagen. And then Seven went up there, Stafford. And they got within, you know, feet of each other. They took pictures of one another, and that worked out okay. So I don't remember them having problems rendezvousing. I mean, I don't remember any aborts. I do with the Russians. The Russians had problems doing it. Back in there.
Yeah, I think you're describing the successful rendezvous, Paul. But there was an earlier attempted rendezvous that was not successful. They ended up using up all of the available control rocket fuel without linking up, because they were doing it in the logical manner. I mean, if the guy's ahead of you and you want to catch up, you blast to speed up. And unless he's only a few feet away, that's not the right thing to do. You got to do the opposite of common sense. So they had to develop that procedure. I'm not convinced that all of those details had been properly ironed out on the first attempt to do a rendezvous. I do remember a very early, I'm pretty sure it was Gemini, rendezvous attempt that had to be aborted. It didn't succeed, even though they used up all of the reaction control system fuel. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
You're talking about when they were trying to rendezvous with the unmanned spacecraft, the Agena. That's what that was. And then eventually, even when they were successful in future flights, the docking didn't work out. and that was Armstrong at the controls on that one. He docked with the Agena, and one of the thrusters got stuck open, and they started rotating quite a bit, you know, quite a pace. I mean, they actually created their gravity up there. That was life-threatening. And that one eventually aborted as well. They used up a lot of fuel on that. So there's been a couple of problems. But yeah, okay, I'm thinking of the two flights that were, they were both manned. But again, there was no docking tower. They were just checking out rendezvous.
When a thruster valve gets stuck open, what is the defense for that, Paul? How did he finally stop that rotation that could have gone to some ridiculous velocity?
I think they just shut the I know he was compensating for it, you know. That's what he was probably using up all that fuel. So finally, they just disconnected from the thing. That was it. That particular one, I think it just ran out of fuel. So, then they were able to, regain control. But I mean, how he was compensating for it at the time, he was firing all the other rocket engines, trying to reverse what was going on.
When it comes to this undesired tumbling motion, rotating motion, didn't that also happen on one of the Apollo missions near the moon? Over to you, Paul.
No, not that I remember. What they were docked with the limb and the whole thing started rotating. Don't remember that one, Dick. Can't help you on that. And I timed out before, about 10 minutes ago. And that's why I said I was losing my voice. I don't know if you heard me, Dick, so I was gonna QRT you. Back to that, WS to my.
Okay, You sound good, Paul, so don't worry. Go ahead, Wes.
Yesterday I had a chance to talk for the first time with Roy and John, and we had a chat. Quite a few hours with many people coming in and going out, and we end up at 4 o'clock in the morning, so 6 p.m. One thing that I started with is a recent revelation about John Brandenburg, American physicist. So I'm bringing it rather to the technet, gathering people, as we have had that for the people who were interested. We covered that with Roy pretty much. Let me jump off. Dr. John Brandenburg, American physicist, specialist in plasma physics, University of California, and employee of Command Aerospace Defense of USA Space Missile Defense. He came with analyzing the radiological data from Mars, and as we all know, and good that we have a space report right now, the attention of humanity wasn't really directed in any way to the radiological data. Many people didn't even have an idea that satellites have devices that would be able to measure that particle data. He came up with something that was very much puzzling and very much for the scientists, putting him in jeopardy. And 2 days later, that was 28th of this month, and 2 days later, the Journal of Cosmology, which is sponsored by CERN, and I've read all of the requirements for the transcript and approval for this transcript, stopped the PDF. So you go to that and it says forbidden. The notion about that is that he implemented the idea of two powerful explosions that have all of the characteristics of a hydrogen bomb that happened on the surface of the Mars. He also pointed out the structure that has the signs of the intelligent creature made, and also some artifacts that he assigned them as most likely anything that remind from the intelligent life on Mars. So the basic history is that he's speculating on the fact that alien race has wiped out the civilization of the Martian that were based on his words in the Bronze Age era. There were a few remaining artifacts that we were able to see, but there might be many on it, and the Mars at a certain time had an atmosphere that was friendly to the intelligent creatures to be there. Now, after that discussion that I had with Roy and John, we went deeper into it, and the speculation evolved to the point that that article is available in Russian side, but it's not available in the original form on American soil. And there was probably a fear of creating a situation, because he postulated immediate action and going to Mars and try to dig for the intelligent life. If there is a powerful alien, or there was a powerful alien civilization that wiped up another civilization that may happen to us as well. Also, another thing is hydrogen bomb step, the footprint, which actually would be the increasing fear of any kind of the explosion or any kind of nuclear experimenting on the planet Earth, not really directed to inform to the warfare, but to other applications, let's say production of the energy. Back to you, Atresia.
Don't forget the Fermi paradox.
Oh, yeah, the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox is, yes, is a contradiction between the estimates or the probability of the existence of extraterrestrial civilization and humanity lack of contact with the evidence for such civilization. He was talking to another gentleman, Fermi, in 1956, and he said that, well, the first sign of any civilization would be noise. And where the hell they are? We have 50. And he speculated that the silence is actually caused by another alien creature who actually goes after the noise and wipe up those civilizations for whatever the reason is. And so now we're dealing with the scientific paper that was stopped from viewing. And then I made the analogy to the Snowden, and then we were trying to speculate with Roy and Dick, I mean in John, about the fact of probability of that happening or anything happening from a philosophical point of view is as if we had time before Snowden and the revelation that were sort of discussed about spying on us, but we didn't have somebody who actually made a proof. So now we will say, well, Snowden could be a big fake. Never happened. But because it was projected to us in such a way that we actually decided politically and personally and as a society or the nations in the world protest against that, or at least notice, hey, something is wrong going on. Was that the revelation of a scientist that was employed in the American warfare as a space missile, or say, Star War technology, now is coming out from the closet with that revelation. And then we were talking with Roy about comfort of sleeping. So somebody sleep. Say, I sleep and I'm talking about baloney. So astronauts that were saying about aliens being on the evidence of aliens, everything is a sort of conspiracy theory. Now, most of those astronauts, they have a comfort of sleeping only after they retire. So my assumption is that famous scientist is no longer in the forces. Now he has a comfort of just saying of being insane or whatever. But you, Dick.
Of the quite a few things that you discussed in those last transmissions, Wes, one of the things you seem to be saying is there was evidence of a hydrogen bomb having been exploded on the surface of Mars. What evidence was there of that? Go ahead.
Okay. The pattern or the footstep that is very much similar to the explosion of the nuclear weaponry, and especially that thermonuclear explosion was a sign to hydrogen bomb was in the area of Martian and